This is the Art of the Hudson Valley, broadcasting locally on WGXC 90.7 FM, Acre, Catskill, Hudson, Greene, and Columbia Counties, New York, and streaming globally online at WGXC.org. I'm your host, Chad Weckler. Today we have two guests who are local writers living on opposite sides of the Hudson River, born on different sides of the Atlantic Ocean. Today, together in Hudson. And we've got Tony Fletcher and Jonathan Gould.
Hey.
Welcome.
Hey. Thanks for having us.
And we're talking, are both of you musicians also?
Yep.
Yep, I can play, just about.
So you're musicians who write about music, basically.
That's a good way to put it. I think of myself, I'm not professionally engaged as a musician anymore, so I think of myself a little bit as a former professional musician, although I still play. I still occasionally play out, not nearly as much as I would like.
John, you're a drummer?
I'm a drummer, yeah.
Yep.
Yeah.
And I would say I'm somebody who aspired to be a professional musician who instead became a professional writer. And that's not an uncommon path. And only in the last 3 or 4 years have I actually picked back up playing the music in my middle age and actually having a great time with it. So I came from a musical family. So I was reading music as young as I was pretty much reading the written word.
Actually, since you're the youngster in the room, Tony, it was interesting to see that you, as a teenager, started writing. You published your own magazine or fanzine as...
Yes. It was definitely called a fanzine at the time. Although sometimes people think that fanzines are about one particular act. And in Britain, when punk rock came along in 1977, there was this explosion in self-produced fanzines. And what they really were an alternative underground publication. So there were just hundreds of essentially Xeroxed, or in my case, Ronio, meaning run off the school Ronio machine, your own little music magazine. They were just everywhere. It was part of the do-it-yourself explosion of punk rock. Mine was anything but punk rock for eternity. It was never really punk rock, but I was 12, 13 when that happened. Mm. And I remember reading about these other fanzines and saying, wow, maybe I could run my own music magazine, because I'd been massively into pop music since I was 8 years old. And the excitement of being in South London in 1977 and feeling the effects of punk rock. I mean, they kind of just like got into our classroom. I mean, they ran very, very deep. So that's how I started out. It was sort of accidental. I had a band at school as well. I always thought it was the band that was going to do it. The band got just about far enough, signed with EMI, Kiss of Death, and instead ended up the magazine carried on progressing. And here I am sort of still writing about music all these years later.
When you did the magazine, it was called Jamming?
Yes.
Were you the sole writer?
No, not initially, and it wasn't really my intent to be. But one thing I found with school friends and bandmates and so on is they didn't mind writing something if you kind of really leaned on them and said, please go home tonight and write me a review of that new record that you're so enthusiastic about. But I was the only person who was going to go to the printers and you haggle with the printers and stay up all night and get this thing really taken care of. So a lot of the time I was writing the majority of it.
Your first book was about Echo and the Bunnymen?
Correct. Northern English band from Liverpool. Was that a deliberate segue, Chad?
We're getting there. We're getting there.
Yeah, Northern English band, yes, from Liverpool. They did a wonderful cover of All You Need Is Love down the line. My magazine carried on all the way up to 1986, and it got bigger and bigger. And as often happens when things get bigger, it kind of lost more and more money. And one day just went belly up. And I was very, very fortunate because although I actually did get saddled with some debts that seemed to take half my life to pay off, that pretty much the day that the magazine went under, a very good friend called me and said, I'm sorry to hear that. I work for this publishing company, and I think the editor is looking for somebody to write a book on Echo and the Bunnymen. And I went to the editor, talked about it. I went to the group and talked about it, and they were amenable. And it turned out to be the official biography of Echo and the Bunnymen, who were very influential at the time. I have to say that was the easiest I've ever had it. Mm. I've never, ever had it so easy where you just say to a band, can I write a book about you with your cooperation? And they say, yeah, sure. So, I don't know. It's gotten steadily harder since then.
Speaking of that segue, now we can go to John, who wrote a book about the Beatles, Can't Buy Me Love. How did that get started?
A spectacularly original idea to write a book about the Beatles. It started because I had been working in the music business for quite some time, mm-hmm. and I was becoming disenchanted, and that maybe is a whole other radio program. Mm. Take one step backwards. One of the ways that I expressed my disenchantment with the music business was to go back to college for a year. I had dropped out of Cornell University in about 1972 in order to play drums in rock bands and jazz groups and so on and so forth. And I had this piece of unfinished business in my life, and I was able economically to just take a year off and do that. And so I did that. Mm. And going back to, you know, college when I was in my 30s then was a completely different experience, and nobody knew what to do with me. And when you're in an academic environment and you have any kind of real world experience that you can bring to bear on whatever it is you're studying, people get very excited about it. And so in the music courses that I took, people would say, oh, you should write about this. You should write about this. You have a perspective on popular music. So with that encouragement, I did nothing for quite a long time, but eventually I decided that I did want to write something about popular music. I'm not a critic. I don't think of myself. I don't like to write about things that I don't like. Mm-hmm. I really only like to write about things that I do like. When you do that, you have to write about other things sometimes, other forms of music that you or groups or so on that you don't like. But anyway, so I wanted to pick something that I was unequivocally enthusiastic about. And one of the things I thought about were the Beatles. I wanted to write about what I thought at this sort of happy conjunction of things, which is that at a certain point, arguably, obviously, the most popular music in the world was also arguably the best popular music in the world. And I think that was in some ways an expression of my disenchantment with where things were in the 1980s in some ways, particularly in America. Where I felt this popular music was becoming this highly institutionalized, it had always been commercialized, but highly institutionalized, rather narrow sort of, playing a rather narrow role in people's lives, an important role, but narrow. Anyway, so I just sat down, and the only thing I knew about writing a book was not to start at the beginning, was just to start. And so I started, and I wrote an indecently long chapter about a very critical juncture in the Beatles' story, the moment when their new drummer Ringo Starr joins the band and they get a recording contract and they make their first records. And that chapter stretched to, I think, 60 pages at least. And then I'm sort of telling the whole story here and I don't want to do that, but this is the way I got into it. I was at a party and I met a fellow named Jake Brackman, who lives in Hudson, New York. And told him what I was doing, and Jake said to me, Jake has a long history as a writer and a lyricist. He was Carly Simon's lyricist. He was a New Yorker writer. He was the film critic for Esquire magazine. You probably should have Jake Brackman on this program sometime. He was a film producer also. Anyway, Jake was and is a major figure. And when I told him what I was doing, he said to me, well, if this thing is as good as you seem to think it is, you should send it to William Shawn. And William Shawn at that time had recently been deposed as the New Yorker, as the editor of the New Yorker magazine. And on Jake was touching a private fantasy of mine, which is that one day I would write something of that quality. It took me a while to actually act on his advice, but I did act on his advice, and I sent this chapter of the book to Mr. Shawn, as everybody called him, who was then an editor at Farrar, Straus, Giroux, and he read it and called me about a week later and wound up telling me that he wanted to publish it, and the only problem was there wasn't anything more. So we spent quite a bit of time first working with him, and then after a couple of years he died, and I was assigned to another excellent editor at Farrar, Straus, and that was how I sort of lucked into becoming a writer of books.
And it took you 20 years?
It took me about, actually, from that conversation to the publication of the book took about 16 years. I'm embarrassed about the fact that it took that long, but when it takes that long, your publisher wants to turn it into something that makes it sound like it's this monumental achievement. My attitude was it should have taken me 7 years, or maybe even less.
if it helps, I'm busy getting towards the end of Pete Townsend's autobiography, yes. And he does let on that he signed the deal in 1996.
Yeah, well, that's encouraging.
And he says yes, for the same book that you're reading right now. So
that's good to know.
Yeah.
That's good to know.
John, when you're doing research, and Tony also, how do you conduct your research?
Well, I think John and I have had, John and I have met before and did a reading before, last year or the year before in Woodstock with another writer on July 4th. We did a British invasion and I read from my book about Keith Moon. And we found that we'd had very different approaches. And I know John can pick up on this because he's now just gone to the other extreme. Everything that I've done is relatively linear and relatively traditional in that I speak to as many people as I can involved in the subject, and then I write the story, and the book will be a balance between my own narrative, my own editorializing, my own kind of reviews within the book, and quotations from the people that I've interviewed. I'm always kind of aspiring to do with less and less quotes, but I also understand that that's part of what makes a biography typically seem sort of like you've done your homework, is that in some ways the more quotes that you can use, the more it might look like you've interviewed people. At the same time, if it's just quotations, people tend to call those cut and paste books. So there's definitely a case of getting a balance. I'm always kind of trying to aspire to the idea of being able to just write a book based on my own knowledge. I actually wrote a very short book on The Clash purely about their music, and it was a song by song history, and it's the only book I didn't have to do any interviews for, and I loved doing it. I loved being able to just go with the information that was there, that was already out in the real world, and then just hone in on each song. And in meeting John, and I'll let him pick up from here, I think that what I liked about his Beatles book was that, having read some others where people have done their interviews, and I think you get to the point where you're trying to find school friends of Lennon and McCartney that are, in their dying days and probably don't remember much and have embellished the stories. And I think John instead decided that his approach would be, I'm going to just take everything that's out there already and figure out the story from, I mean, is that correct?
Yeah. Again, because there was so much material out there. The Beatles themselves had been interviewed countless times, as we all know. They published what was in effect an autobiography in 1968, really the first serious book in any way about a rock band, which was their Hunter Davies' book, which was very well done. And then over the years, they had all of them reflected on it, sometimes at enormous length. I mean, John Lennon gave a long, long interview. They all did in this way. So for me, I thought that's all been done. All the interviewing has been done. Yes, questions may come up. The goal was to make sense of this, and also especially to put this in some kind of a social context, even a historical context. I mean, not to be pretentious about it, but they are an aspect of history. And so with the Beatle book, I read very, very extensively about, in contemporary sources, about Britain and America in the 40s, 50s, and 60s, the period when they were growing up. I wanted to be able to write about their experience in Britain with some shred of authority, like I knew what I was talking about. And that the only way to do that is to immerse yourself in materials of the time. And so that was the method with that. And the balance for that, all of that social context, was to write, which I do try to do, very closely about the music, about what's actually happening in the songs, what's actually happening in on the records. Some of my initial desire to write about music had to do with the fact that I didn't think that when people wrote about the work of making music, they wrote about it in a way that seemed, many people, that is to say, knowledgeable. It's work. It's a process. It's people getting together, especially in rock bands or in collaborative songwriting situations. And you piece this thing together, and there isn't a lot of preconception of what you're going to do. It's an organic process. It's like it's what a painter does when he or she makes a painting. It's a familiar thing. And recording, by the way, has made that even more like that, because there's such an opportunity for self-reflection in the recording process as it's developed in the post-Beatle era, I guess you can say. Now I'm doing something completely different, though. Now I'm writing, my current project is a biography of the soul singer Otis Redding, who, in my judgment, remains probably the most important black music star, black singer of his generation who hasn't been the subject of a major biography. I'm trying to do justice to his short but quite extraordinary career. With Otis, Otis died in 1967. Otis died in December 1967. Rolling Stone magazine was founded in November 1967. What that means is Otis died before the phenomenon of the rock press. He lived and worked in an era when mainstream publications in America, from the New York Times to Life magazine to anything like that, did not publish articles about R&B singers. Occasionally, someone would publish an article about an artist of the magnitude of, say, Ray Charles. But there is no, the file of contemporary writing about Otis is almost non-existent. The file of contemporary writing about the Beatles was feet thick, yeah, as far as this goes. And so I'm now dependent on the interview process that Tony described, where you contact people and you ask them to speak with you. And there are two things complicating that. One is we're dealing with events that occurred 50, 60 in some cases, or 40, 50 years ago. And we all know, any listener to this program can think, if I asked you about something that happened in your life 40 years ago, provided you were alive 40 years ago, people's memories are extremely imaginative, is the best word for it. So I'm in the position of having to solicit their memories, and then place their memories into some kind of a plausible context based on what I know about what did happen. And it's very exciting because I'm a kind of social person, so I like meeting people, I like engaging people, but it's also enormously frustrating because what you come out of it with is this vast amount of incredibly contradictory information. That's all, most of which is delivered with an air of complete authority. These, after all, were the people who were there.
This is a very, very, very common issue, and it doesn't matter whether it was 50 years ago, really, or 5 years ago. It's kind of true to say that once an event has happened, then it becomes open to interpretation. And that's actually, I've said before, this is why we have court cases, because very often the court case, there's no question that, for example, so-and-so shot so-and-so else. It's down to who said what? What was the provocation? Mm-hmm. What happened? And everybody has a different memory of something. So as a biographer, you can get caught up in, I mean, when I wrote the book about my biggest book to date, in both in terms of volume and I guess in terms of sales, was my Keith Moon biography. And Keith Moon's life story was sort of built on excess, and built on anecdotes and excessive anecdotes. Mm-hmm. And trying to separate fact from fiction was incredibly hard. And every time I busted a myth, like the famed car in the swimming pool, or being banned from the Holiday Inns, which turned out, really, both of those things turned out not to be the case, I felt like a traitor, because I'd grown up as a kid loving these stories. I mean, just loving the idea that the Who were so wild that they would drive a car into a hotel swimming pool and they'd be banned from Holiday Inns forever. So that's a hard part of the process. And in my new book, which is a biography of The Smiths, another Northern English band from Manchester, who were active in the 1980s. I'm talking to people who were very, very, very much there, and it's amazing how they can write somebody into a scene or somebody out of a scene. Mm-hmm. And a very quick example, and this is getting into minutia, but it tells you what you can be up against as an author. I interviewed somebody who had been a musician who played with members of the Smiths in a previous band, and we were talking about somebody who had been very instrumental in that area of Manchester, who'd been very, very talented, but who actually died young. And not only did I end up with contradictions about how he had died and whether it was alcohol related or simply a brain hemorrhage that was not alcohol related, this guy told me about, all of us, including members of the Smiths, were at the funeral and we played, etc. When the book came out, somebody else who was at the funeral said, well, actually, that person wasn't there, I can assure you. I go back to the manuscript, the transcript of the interview. It says that person was there. I drop him an email and say, this has just been called in the question. There will be reprints. I'd like to get it right. And he says, oh, I don't know who told you that other person was there. I never would have done. And and I've got the tape and the the transcript. So that's something that you're up against. Now, does that sort of affect the bigger story? No, it doesn't. But it's part of what you come up against on a regular basis. And you have to swallow some of this. You're going to get the occasional thing, quote, wrong, because it's going to be open to interpretation to some degree.
Well, the writing of the song, the collaboration with musicians, I'm sure, is intertwined with a lot of confusion as to who came up with that note or that lyric, because they're just creating at the moment.
Yeah, well, you know, I mean, Lennon and McCartney might be one of the most famous cases of that. These were two people who wrote songs together from the very beginning. I mean, from the beginning of almost their initial interest in music. They met so young. They worked together. And after the Beatles broke up, John Lennon gave a famous interview in Rolling Stone magazine in which he presumed, in a very angry state, I might add, about what had happened, gave an interview in which he presumed to disenchant the myth of Lennon and McCartney as collaborators. And he went through this and he said, I did this and Paul did that and he had nothing to do with this and so on and so forth. And it was Lennon in his reactive mode. And for a generation of people who had grown up with this idea that they were the Rodgers and Hart of their time, or the Rodgers and Hammerstein of their time, or you know, one of these great, suddenly it appeared that no, they weren't that. Well, you know, the truth of the matter is they worked together all the time. They wrote together all the time. Different people came up with different things, but the larger truth about it all was each was the first audience for virtually everything that the other did. And it would be impossible to distinguish who did what in the context of this. Somebody might play a chord and the other person might raise their eyebrow at that chord, causing the first person to try a different chord at that moment. And I wound up, after working through all of the, you know, the gradations of who did what, understanding that actually the relationship was even more collaborative than I had ever imagined, because that reactive. And of course, what changed later on, and it really did change, was that the Beatles sort of ceased to exist when Yoko Ono, rather than Paul McCartney, became the primary audience for anything that John Lennon did. That was the end of that collaboration, and at that point, it was legitimate to say they were working in separate worlds.
John, what do you think about McCartney's sort of view of the past and that collaboration of who did what? And
well, I find him, again, Lennon so took the lead in setting the narrative in the years after, immediately after the Beatles broke up, that McCartney has been in this reactive mode to it almost the whole time. So he seems often like a spurned lover, which I don't think is inappropriate, because I think in an artistic sense they were like lovers. And it pains me to hear the way he struggles to try to either put himself into it or to the things that he's not very interesting for the most part when he talks about writing those songs. He tends to focus on what he thinks of as quirky, interesting details. And you talk about the strange, the way that people incorporate things. To me, the strangest thing of all, and the Beatles, Paul McCartney, when the Beatles were in India, wrote a perfectly beautiful song called Blackbird. And he wrote it because, among other things, at this place they were staying at the Maharishi's ashram in India, there were all these blackbirds all over the trees. And the song is exactly what it says. The metaphors in it are not very complex, and they don't need to be. Shortly, that song came out on the White Album. One of the more bizarre reactions to the Beatles' music, of course, was that of the Manson family, Charlie Manson, who developed this whole theory about that album, one aspect of which was the idea that the song Blackbird was actually a kind of secret message to African Americans all across America to arise in a revolutionary sense. And this was, again, one of the bizarre things that people read into the Beatles' music, and it was always existed in that way until about 10 years ago, for reasons that I can only speculate on, Paul McCartney started to incorporate into his descriptions of how various songs came to be written the idea that Blackbird was inspired by some black woman that he knew, and basically bought into the whole Manson interpretation of the song. What do you do with that? I mean, as a biographer, I did nothing about it, with it. I just thought he can say anything he wants about the song. Certainly the song is not enriched by that interpretation. I think it's much more interesting as is, so to speak, with the metaphor of a blackbird being a blackbird and the metaphor of birdsong being birdsong. Mm-hmm. But again, what do you do with that? I mean, this is something which has percolated into his consciousness, probably from the culture that he's decided is a more interesting interpretation of the song than the one he gave for 20 years.
what intrigues both of you when you sit down and you decide to write a book? Do you want to bring some of the hidden aspects of music, the musicians out? Do you want to try and keep it clean? What's the motivation?
Well, there's a difficult balance to strike. Something that John said earlier is also something I subscribe to, which is that I really want to write about the stuff that turns me on rather than what turns me off. I mean, I have a website, and if something really angers me or me off, I have an outlet for that. Mm. Yeah, that's usually going to be something more political by nature. But when it comes to writing books and writing my magazine, it was a fanzine, I wrote about the stuff that infused me. So I could talk about the Keith Moon book, but it's getting on to being 15 years old now. So to talk about the Smiths book, which is new and it's out there. And a lot of what you were talking about with Lennon and McCartney, you know, Morrissey and Mara are held up in Britain now. In America, they're still seen as a cult group because that's what they were. But in Britain, the Smiths are held up as being as influential and important as the Beatles, mm-hmm. the Stones, the Who, the Clash, maybe the Jam, the Kinks, and the Smiths. Mm. And Morrissey and Marr is seen as a partnership up there with Lennon and McCartney, or perhaps more Jagger and Richards mm-hmm. in terms of the delineation of the work. So I'm dealing with people who are all alive. I'm trying to get their cooperation, and I get it to varying degrees. So I get two members of the band to cooperate completely, and I get just about everybody else who's around the band. I love the band's music. I have nothing but respect for the individuals. And at the same time, I don't want to sugarcoat what went on within the group. In the case of the Smiths, it's well known that unfortunately there was a court case after they broke up that's been very, very damaging to their legacy, because Morrissey and Marr did not give the rhythm section an equal share in the recording and touring mm-hmm. costs. They already had the publishing, but they sort of kept the others on a 10%, but they never got it written down. So when the band broke up and the rhythm section are looking to, like, how do we survive, you know, what do we do with the rest of our lives, it went all the way to the High Court. There's also lots of documented cases of sort of, you know, just pretty ritualistic rock star hedonism. And there's also the case of a band member who's thrown out for his heroin use and then reinstated. Now, I'm trying to deal with all of that, and I know it helps make the book. And that's not touching on Morrissey's sexuality, which, by the way, I did a radio show with a very similar station, WIOX, over in Roxbury just last week, and I think we were 30 minutes talking about Morrissey's sexuality before I could move the conversation on. That was as a result of the person who was interviewing me, who was very, very, very informed and part of the LGBT community. So all of these things are out there. Some people have said to me, you haven't written enough about Morrissey's sexuality, and some people have said that, you know, anything that you write is invasive. So you're really trying to strike this kind of balance. That the hardest thing I had to deal with was and is Johnny Marr, the guitarist and musician. So this is why their partnership was more like a Jagger Richards. You had Johnny Marr and the Keith Richards model, and you have Morrissey as the Mick Jagger model, doing the lyrics and the singing and being the front man. So their partnership did very much depend on each other in a way that Lennon and McCartney could eventually pull apart. Johnny Marr in the Smiths, you know, we're the same age. He's we've got a lot of respect for each other. He gave of himself enormously for the book. But during the Smiths, he was not just a workaholic. He drank a lot. He particularly, you know, partied a lot. And this is all by his own admission. He was as thin as a stick, like a Keith Richards kind of character. And he got the job done until he sort of collapsed from exhaustion and left the band. Now, and then he joined, like, several other bands, including the Pretenders and Talking Heads and the a massively talented guy. Now in his late 40s, he happens to be teetotal, vegan, Buddhist, marathon runner, with which I share a few of those things, though not the teetotal part. And so his perspective now is this from a very wise, mature adult. So when he's telling stories about what they got up to when they were younger, you know, he's giving this different perspective, that if you take the quote verbatim from when you gave me the interview in, you know, 2010 or 2011, it doesn't really perfectly gel with the Johnny Marr of 1985. That is one of the hardest things I had to deal with this book, was somebody who was very clear, was able to look back and say, well, that was me then. That was a Smith then. I wouldn't make the same decisions now. I would recommend to bands to share the money, etc. I had to then, you know, balance that with, well, Johnny, at the time, this is what you did, and can you answer for yourself, you know, within the context of that particular period and what you did? And that's probably as I may not be answering the question that you asked, which was a few minutes ago, but that's part of the problem and the dilemma and the excitement of what you're trying to do. If you're trying to tell the story, you want to be fair to your subjects, but you also want to be honest about them, and you want to be fair to the readers who want something more. And most of the people who's bought my Smith's book are fans. But I do believe the majority of them are fans who want to get a bit more information than they've had before. So they've got to trust me not to sell the band out, you know, not to sell the band short, to tell the truth, not to sugarcoat it, and not to come down on the side of an Albert Goldman where you start getting vicious and possibly libelous and mean.
Your job is to, or you aspire to, reveal history in its sort of objective sense, but then you're also interested in the behind the mind, what's going on, and what drove certain decisions.
Exactly.
Which is, could be revealing in a presence of someone trying to remember, but also interesting, even if you go back to something that was written in the 70s or 80s that was supposed to have been objective, may not really have been. And so you're trying to figure it out for yourself as an author.
Yeah. Well, absolutely. I mean, two essential sort of creeds. First one, and this is the great problem of the journalistic approach, which is just because somebody says something doesn't mean that it's true. Reporters go out and they generate credibility for what they write by getting quotes. And this can happen on an immediate level. Just because somebody says it, just because somebody was there, that doesn't mean that it's true. Okay, that's one of the problems that you deal with. And it's especially a problem that you deal with when you get wonderful information from somebody, when somebody tells you a wonderful anecdote, and it's just irresistible from a literary point of view, from a writerly point of view. But then you have to subject it to the question of, could this have happened? Could this have happened this way? So on and so forth. It's also true that just because somebody writes something doesn't mean that it's true. So all of these forms of authority that you're, on the one hand, you're drawing on, eyewitness testimony or the writing of contemporary sources and things like that, you have to subject it to this great scrutiny. That's one side of it. The other side of it is this, from my point of view anyway, and I think probably from Tony's point of view also. I took a course at Cornell with a wonderful teacher there that was it was an anthropology course, and it was about developing a portrait of somebody. You could do it in photography, you could do it in painting, you could do it in writing, you could do it any way you wanted. You could write a song about this someone. But you had to focus on one person, and the whole course was about generating a portrait over there. And the teacher said something to us that was based on his experience doing anthropological source work, which was, he said, you know, if you look closely at somebody's life any length of time, there's a very good chance that you're going to fall in love with them, and you just really, you have to take that into account. And I found that sort of true. Now, of course, the other side of that, you were talking about Albert Goldman. When you live with a biographical subject or a group of biographical subjects for any length of time, they come to dominate your life. You get up every morning, and in addition to your partner or your kids or whatever it is, there's that person too. And there is a possibility, you know, there are days that you hate that person. You just can't stand them anymore, this sort of thing. But overall, I do fall in love with my subjects. But then I do a thing that most people who fall in love with somebody don't necessarily have to do. In fact, it would be pretty damaging to do it, which is to subject them and their story to this constant scrutiny and this constant skepticism. And that's the kind of, that's what's really intriguing about doing this kind of work. And it's also what's really hard about doing this kind of work, because at certain points, I don't know if you feel this way, you just don't know what you think about anything. You have so much material. There are so many contradictory views of a personality or of an incident or something like this, and you're asking yourself, what happened? Who were they? What's going on here? And of course, you resolve those questions as best you can, and that's your book in the end.
I had that. I had to deal with that probably more so when I was writing this book, All Hopped Up and Ready to Go, Music from the Streets of New York, which is a 50-year history of what it says it is, and each chapter was about a genre and a style of music. And that's where, when you're taking a wide-angle view, that's where you get into a lot of kind of disputed stories and a lot of anecdotal legends, and trying to dig deeper into some of that got very, very confusing. And ultimately, there were times when I had to step back and say, at the end of the day, is this make or break? I mean, you know, not does it matter, because it does to some degree, but really, is it make or break? Am I trying to tell a story, or am I trying to kind of, you know, uncover the writing of the Bible here? one of the hardest things I've ever come up against. I went into writing about Keith Moon, absolutely, as you said, in love with the guy. I was such a massive Who fan. He was like an idol. I met him just before he died. It's it's in the epilogue. It's very kind of been very key to my life. The last person I interviewed for the book was his wife. She had never had given an interview, not for all the money that Rupert Murdoch's media could throw at her. And she was now married to Ian McLagan. I went down to Texas and stayed with them. I mean, she had basically been watching my path through this book. And I knew by now that Keith had bigger demons than I thought, that they had arrived earlier than I thought, that he was more of a bore than I thought and had ended up being more aggressive than I thought. I had no idea he had been abusive to his wife, too physically abusive. And, you know, to the point of breaking her nose several times. And she was a female model as well. So that's kind of not a cool thing to do. And there was a point in my book I allowed myself as the author in this particular case, I allowed my sort of fandom of Keith to be a driving force in the book. So I'm in the shadows, but I am the person telling the story. I am the narrator. You're aware that it's not all third person. And there was a point where Keith's ex-wife, Kim, her father came around to kind of teach Keith a lesson. And I just found myself writing something along the lines of, you know, you kind of really wish he had, or I really wish he had. And because that's how I felt. And I left it in, and a lot of people identified with it. Because at that point, you really thought, oh my God, this guy is out of control and somebody needs to teach him a lesson. And so, you know, that's kind of, it's interesting. I don't do that at all with the Smiths book. I felt the need to do that with the Keith Moon book. I think it's something that made it quite interesting. But yeah, I came away a little less enamored of the guy than when I had started out.
Tony, as you were talking about putting things in and taking things out, is there something in the Smiths book that you took out, didn't put in?
Yes. Yes, there are a few things. I always have to pause. I'm a good talker, but I have to, with this, I have to think first. Morrissey, the lead singer of the Smiths, has been known he did recently take the Enemy to court, the British music paper, and as a result, and some other actions of his, the libel lawyers that paid a lot of close attention to my book. And the libel lawyers are fantastic, because what they do is they raise a whole bunch of sort of hypotheses of you know what you're putting in there and what might be the problem. And then when you ask them for an opinion, you know, they're lawyers and they won't give you an opinion. Mm. And so they basically throw it back at you, and there's something in your contract that may or may not say that you're responsible at the end of the day. And then your editor kind of hums and haws. And I found that it was really kind of just left to me at the end of all of this to decide whether the issues that were raised were ones that should stay in the book or not stay in the book. The fact that the book's been out several months and it seems to be received well enough, and I am going to sort of touch wood here that I'm on safe ground. I did get a lot of correspondence that Morrissey had written. He's a very literary character. He was obsessed with Oscar Wilde. That was his major influence. And as somebody who was a recluse, not a total recluse, but I identify with characters like this. He spent a lot of his teenage years and his early 20s in his bedroom, firing off letters to the music papers, getting pen pals. I mean, he was the only person I think in history that's known to have had, you know, two letters in the same music paper twice in two different papers in the same week or something like that. The correspondence was endless, including to other musicians, including to Tony Wilson, who was the founder of Factory Records and the Hacienda nightclub. And a lot of people gave me a lot of correspondence, and the correspondence is fascinating. I mean, it's Morrissey at his best, his wittiest, also at his most revealing, and to some degrees at his worst. But there's a limit to how much of that you can print. And I think, you know, that's the kind of thing that you say, wow, this is, you know, I mean, somebody could just publish a book of his letters, but you can't. So that's something that I came up with. And again, trying to be respectful, trying to strike that balance. There's a couple of other things that did have to be taken out. And people have, you phrase this somewhat differently, but even yesterday I was doing an interview where somebody, it's a very standard question, what's the most surprising thing you discovered? And I have to say, it's the stuff that's not in the book. And leave it there.
Writing for me, and I think for most people, is, it's here again, this is process. You cram everything in, and then the real writing is taking stuff out. The real writing is, you cram all this information in, And then you start the only, and it's unwieldy, it's unmanageable, it's contradictory, and in some cases incomprehensible. And then you start drawing things out, and this is, I guess, almost a sculptural metaphor. Mm. And eventually you get the book in this way. So, you know, you in some ways, after a long period of cramming stuff in, you do almost nothing but take things out. And when you take things out, you're making a whole series of literary, but also moral judgments about what needs to be there, what belongs there. I'm dealing with a lot of that right now. And what Tony was saying, I think, is very true. This isn't investigative journalism, okay? It's not as if just because you learn something, it needs to be there. Even if it's I'll give you the obvious example that I deal with on a constant basis. I have been for the last several years in the process of enlisting the cooperation of Otis Redding's family in helping me write this book. And I, as a result, I've become an expert on what their sensitivities are. Otis's widow, who is a woman named Zelma, who lives in Macon, Georgia, and is now 71 years old, has spent the last 45 years not only being Mrs. Otis Redding, but that is to say, since his death, but also managing his legacy in a very very effective way. And among her obvious sensitivities is the fact that Otis was on the road for three quarters of the year. He was a soul singer, he was a sex symbol, and he had relationships with other people. Now the question becomes, and Zelma understandably is sensitive about this, which is a fairly commonly known fact. The more interesting part of Otis's life, though, has to do, since what I've just described is the rule for people in his position, the more interesting part of Otis's life has to do with his devotion to his family, his devotion to his wife, his devotion to his hometown, none of which seems to have been compromised by relationships which were physical relationships that he had when he was away from home. So the, one of the large questions becomes how important is that dimension of his life? And in my opinion, it's not very important at all. I don't think that aspect of the life of professional entertainers or anybody else who's in that position of touring and so on and so forth, if he had had relationships with people who influenced him artistically in an important way, let's say, or caused him to make decisions that he otherwise, then it becomes sort of relevant. But just as a sort of kind of constant fact of his life, it's not really very important, and I don't feel a need to do anything more than sort of allude to it for the most part, because it's not interesting information, even though it might be something that people who are fans of Otis Redding want to know more about. And what I'm doing there is I'm playing a little bit of a role. I'm saying no, that's not what's important about him. This is what's important about him, and that's my prerogative as an author, is to make that decision.
Well, how much of the Otis Redding archive, his life, his recordings, are still here?
The music is all totally available. It's one of the wonders of the world we live in nowadays. Records don't really go out of print anymore. I mean, they in rare cases they do, but for the most part, that's all available. As I say, in terms of the written record, there wasn't much to begin with, but Otis is still... I was amazed to read in a press release that BMI put out about 2 years ago that Sitting on the Dock of the Bay is one of the 10 most played songs in their catalog. That's an enormous catalog. It's most of black music since the 40s. I think it's the 7th most commonly played, and I think that means it has something like, I assume we have to be talking about billions here. So I think it's been played 7 billion times or something like that on the radio. Could it be billions? It can't be millions.
It possibly could be, because there are these hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of radio stations, and you're right.
Sure.
This is a song you just keep hearing.
Now, I was stunned to know. I mean, again, one of the things I would like to think is that he's a bit more obscure than that, since part of my job is to make him, is to bring him to, you know, renewed public consciousness. But his music is still very much with us in that way. And again, one of the nice things about writing a book about him is there's so many people who have such an appreciation is not the right word for his music, such a love of his music. I think that is the right word. That when you casually meet people and tell them what you're doing, they light up. They think, oh my goodness, that's wonderful. You know, and they ask if anything else has been written, and the answer is not much, and you go from there.
The creative industry is a very difficult industry to make a living at. So when you have the Smiths or the Beatles and Otis Redding, those are the very few people that actually reached a level of stardom. And there are so many mm-hmm. people that will never reach that level. But the stories of those people are probably much more interesting.
Well, you're foreshadowing my next book. And what I hope is my next book, that is to say, if I can get a contract to write this book. There was a extraordinarily idiosyncratic and influential New Orleans piano player named Professor Longhair. His real name was Henry Roland Byrd. He played under the name Professor Longhair. Mm. He is an icon of New Orleans music. He wrote the song Mardi Gras in New Orleans, which is an annual feature of Mardi Gras in New Orleans. He wrote the song Tipitina. Longhair is an example of a musician who was enormously influential and largely unsuccessful. That is to say, he had a hard time making any kind of a living in the record business. There's a trajectory of his career, which is that after having a few sort of small R&B hits in the early 1950s, he then spent years supporting his family as best he could as a card shark, as a janitor working in a record store. And then in the early 1970s was, quote-unquote, rediscovered. It's an odd way that we use that word, but he was rediscovered, which means he was rediscovered by white people in New Orleans. And in the 70s had managed to make a real living playing music. But I want to write about Longhair because, first of all, because I love his music and because he's an example of a pure stylist. And it's very interesting to me to think about writing about the whole notion of specifically style. You know, Nabokov once said that all I am is a style as a writer. It was his fear that all he amounted to was a style. But there is a way in which that applies to many great artists. Mm. That's what they are, as a style. Longhair is that as a musician. But I also want to write about exactly the phenomenon you talk about, which is people of great talent who don't have careers, who have extremely compromised careers in whatever field that they do. And the problem then becomes, when you write about the Beatles, I mean, one of my favorite statements about the Beatles is Ned Roram's statement, where he wrote in the New York Review of Books, of all places, in 1967, an essay that included the line, "The Beatles are good even though everybody already knows that they're good." And so when you write about the Beatles, you don't need to affirm their goodness. Everybody knows it. Everybody knows that they were talented. Everybody knows all of that. With someone like Longhair, though, it's a different story. You can't fall back on his popularity as the measure of his talent. You have to write about it in itself. And that's an interesting thought to me, an interesting problem to me.
Are most musicians writers, in a sense that they write music, would you say?
Do you mean write it in the old-fashioned way?
Yeah.
No. I don't think Lennon and McCartney were, as I remember from your book. I don't believe they were. I think one of the wonders of music is that it's innate. I have an 8-year-old boy who's very, very talented on the guitar, alarmingly talented. And because he's very excited, because he's 8, and only just 8, it's very, very hard to get him to actually learn the structure of music. He's really not interested in learning the structure of music in terms of this is the C note, the D note, and E and B don't have sharps, and that's the nature of the keyboard. He is totally aware of how to play chords, and he can remember chords like photographic memory, and he's getting to the point that he really knows what sounds right. So he's starting to really riff on his guitar. And he can play some pretty cool Beatles songs. He can play Here Comes the Sun pretty much perfectly. And he does this really by instinct. And his guitar teacher is saying, this is not unusual. He's figuring out for himself that when you play a D chord, it kind of makes sense to go to a C or a G or maybe an A, and not necessarily, like an F, an F. But we know what we're talking about here. Very, very, very interesting. This is not somebody who's sitting down saying, "Well, show me how the chords are structured." He's kind of a little resistant to learning the piano in that sense. I think that's really common. Johnny Marr, who's a genius on the guitar and can play other instruments, never really sat down and learned how to write or read music. It's all done by listening to music, figuring out the chords, learning how to play the chords, and then it becomes its own language. One of the things, slight kind of dovetail, but there was an interesting book came out by another guy who lives up here. here part of the time, and it's called Guitar Zero, and the author was Gary Marcus, was essentially had been told all his life he was arrhythmic, like he has no musical talent whatsoever. He is incapable of music. He is also a professor at NYU and a professor of developmental studies, so he was able to get a sabbatical and a book deal to see if that was true or not, and decided to try and learn the guitar in a year. And he writes this whole thing about the guitar makes no sense. When you look at it mathematically, mm-hmm. it makes no sense. But, you know, somebody got that one right, because when you watch little kids whose fingers can just move from one chord to another, you realize that actually we developed that instrument correctly. There's something between our brain and our fingers that allows us to play guitar without actually knowing what it is we're really doing or what notes we're playing. We just know that this is right and we can remember these chords. I find that part of it fascinating, the fact that you don't need to read or write music. And I came from a classical musical family, so that was kind of ingrained in me. And happy though I was to have that, I also realized that you don't need it.
The other part of that, of course, is having any grasp of theory, or as we describe it. Almost all popular musicians play by ear, whether they can read or not. I mean, essentially, you learn by ear, you play by ear. In the era of recordings, which is the last 100 years, basically, in which music has been readily available, it has revolutionized music making in unimaginable ways. Before that, notation was the only way that music could be preserved. It was the only way that music could travel over distances. You wrote a score in Vienna, and you transported it to London, and people there could know what that music is. But recording has so thoroughly revolutionized the musical world. It's like the equivalent of the invention of the printing press or something like that in terms of, and of course there's a problem with that, which is that nowadays, almost everybody lives with access to almost, if they seek it out, and it's not hard to seek it out, it's a couple of mouse clicks, with access to all music. It's all available to you. And the problem with that is that so much of music is, of interesting music has been created in ethnic or cultural backwaters, has been created in places where the nature of the music that exists there came from strange collisions of cultural collisions. New Orleans is an obvious example of that, but every place is an example of that. Kansas City, Missouri is an example of that. That now those backwaters have largely dried up. The last really great backwater that's affected the world of popular music was one could say was reggae in the 70s and Afropop in the 80s. Those were the last sort of huge wells of places that were not on the Western cultural grid, or that had a tenuous connection to the Western cultural grid, where strange things happened.
Well, what happens now for a musician who wants to be a professional musician?
Well, I think one of the we've been talking very much about traditional music here. We're talking about rock music, mm-hmm. and we're talking about soul music for the most part. And I also have a great love for electronic music and dance music, and of course GXC as a radio station thrives, and it was almost built on the idea of you know experimental music. And this is where you get into the idea that music can be constructed of all kinds of different things. And I found myself almost inadvertently, almost by accident, DJing in the 1990s and becoming pretty. We're certainly getting to enjoy it. And by that, I mean club DJing. Mm. Really getting to enjoy it, enjoying the maths of beat mixing and the rhythm of cutting from one track to another and blending songs on top of each other. And a lot of people can get to do that. And there's obviously, as we know, I mean, I presume that the listeners know, you know, there is a culture in which the DJ is the superstar, and some of the top paid musicians in the world right now are not musicians per se, but DJs. Mm-hmm. And these are people who can play to 20,000 people a night simply by playing music. Mm-hmm. And it's a combination of their personality and their DJ mixing skills. You also have hip hop producers or R&B producers who likewise have never grown up studying music, but they provide the beats and the productions for the biggest records in the world. You know, Rihanna's new album, I think, had a different songwriter and producer, certainly I think a different songwriter for every track. So sometimes these people become the biggest names. And I was particularly taken by after what we've kind of called the rave scene, which kind of grew out of acid house, which grew out of techno, which is going to mean nothing to a lot of people, but it means a lot to me. And it all came from Detroit and Chicago, which are the two big black cities of Northern America popular music. the whole culture grew up of people making records in their bedroom before the music got quite as easy to make as it is now. And people just got really good at figuring out how to cut up drum beats and rearrange them on a very, very basic computer. And they got really good at the idea of making sounds. And there was a music that came along that's been known as drum and bass and has mutated into what's now dubstep. And as the name might suggest, drum and bass had a lot of very fast drum rhythms and a lot of very, very deep bass. And one of the beautiful things I learned about that is the standard deep bass note that was so deep you wondered how it had been invented was apparently sampled by turning on a sampler. So that, I mean, literally somebody at some point had gone, wow, that sound when we turned on that machine and but the tape was running, that sound is just phenomenal. And they turned that into a new instrument. So for me, you see, I think that music just keeps reinventing. I just think that to some point we have to get out of the way. We can talk about the Beatles and the Smiths and hopefully their music endures. But if you are a teenager and you're immersed in the world of dubstep, this may just seem incredibly arcane and just, you know, we're their grandparents, you know, we're their out of touch grandparents.
That's true. Yeah. I mean, it's bizarre when I think about it. So when to take the Beatles. The Beatles occurred in my life in early 1964, and at that time, nobody in my world was thinking about Benny Goodman, let's just say. Well, you know, Benny Goodman, in some ways, was the Beatles of his day. Benny Goodman in 1936 exploded onto the consciousness of America in the same way that the Beatles exploded onto the consciousness of America in 1964. It was less than 30 years before. Now we live in a world in which people like me and people like Tony, who's a bit younger than I am, are sitting in studios in 2012 talking about music that's 50 years old as if it has some currency at all. Now, of course, Benny Goodman has regained some currency because he, too, is now incorporated into this great historical mix that we all live with in that way. But I am amazed by that, and I do share some of the concern that I think it's a concern, it's a legitimate concern that Tony's sort of alluding to, which is that, you know, how do you escape from the past? How do you shunt the past aside so that something new can happen? As opposed to, you know, the way that when my kids were growing up, I would drive them crazy because every new group that they came up with, to me it was, oh, that sounds like the Kinks. Oh, that sounds like, you know, and it was like, and they were, what, you know, their attitude was, I don't want to know that it sounds like something that's happened before, even though we all know from, you know, that on one level there's nothing new under the sun, but what there is new under the sun is endless recombinations of things that represent what we call new.
Well, that actually gets us to the end of the program. I almost want to do a part B or side B to this side A. So I want to thank both of you for being here, John and Tony. Thank you very much. It's been a very engaging hour that went by very quickly.
Thank you for having us. And this is what happens when you have two people who can talk endlessly on the same show. We sort of just trade back and forth like here, right?
It's like Chad. I'm sorry. I think we took over your show there, but you were very patient. Thanks so much for having us on. This was very enjoyable.
It's a pleasure.
No, and thank you, listeners, for listening to The Art of the Hudson Valley this month. And we'll see you next month. And don't forget, create.